Chapter 6. An Excitable Boy. I stumble through my hotel room's doorway just after 11 o'clock, bone tired and shaky from the post-adrenaline crash. I'm still only half certain there's a chance that my paper plane will leave the runway. Mary and I put in nearly 4 hours on the key strategy proposal and my presentation, and she kicked the tires very thoroughly before she handed me the metaphorical air hose. If she can be trusted to hold up her end of the deal, we might be able to make it fly. If. Ah well. I may not trust her personally. Actually, I can barely hold back my fight-flight impulse in her presence, but I can't fault her motivation. If I can learn not to break out in a hot flush, or get the shudders, or random stabs of ossified reflexive jealousy when she walks in the door. And if she can learn not to jump out of her skin when I pick up my violin case, as she did when we were leaving, and then she tried to make a shaky voice joke of it. We can make policy faster than a speeding bullet and leap tall buildings full of paperwork. But it's going to take practice. And a lot of patience. Once I crawl between the sheets, I go out like a lamp. Sleep is dreamless at first, but sometime in the small hours I awaken just enough to do the bathroom sleepwalk shuffle, and when I go back to bed, I start to dream. I'm on that monochrome dance floor again, whirling in the arms of my white-clad faceless lover. This time, it's no waltz. I'm gothed up like my mid-teenaged self's vision of her aspirational adult persona. All rather jejune, with way too much black lace. What can I say? It was a phase I was going through, as we danced to a new romantic 80s synth-pop beat. There's a band between the columns of speakers, faceless men in suits surrounded by a wall of ancient Korg and Yamaha kit. The Damned Don't Cry. Enola Gay. As we whirl to the dance floor beat, I feel like a machine, as soulless as my partner, who leans towards my face and whispers, "You could have taken her soul." "You say that like you think I should want it." His voice is autumn leaves blowing through the doorway of an open crypt. Mine is toneless. He pulls me closer. "You should have taken her. She lied to you." I can't kill people just because they lie to me, or because I don't like them. He laughs and whirls me in a tight circle. I lean backwards, relying on his arms around me for support. "You've killed people you didn't like before. Firouz, the Prisdaran lieutenant in Vakilabad. The nest of idiot goat worshippers in Amstelveen. You're..." "Shut up and dance." It's not a very goth dance. It's far too intimate. I break out of his grip, sway sidelong away, then catch the rhythm. Grab the bat, hug the bat, drop the bat, work those hips, raise your arms, big box, little box, big box, little box, back to swaying on the spot. Grab the bat, hug the bat, drop the bat, kick the bat across the dance floor. Then I grab the bat again and suddenly find my arms filled by my dance partner. His arms wrapped around me like the steel bars of an impossible cage.
"Love is all you need,"
he whispers breathily in my ear and runs his tongue down the side of my neck to the base of my throat. The rasp of his flinty tongue strikes a spark that sets me on fire. I wrap my arms around him and play intimate chords of power on the fingerboard of his spine. He shivers eerily and lifts me, and I wrap my knees around his hips then. The logic of dreams hold no brief for zippers, underwear, or hook-and-eye fasteners. His teeth are locked around my painfully taut right nipple as he lowers me onto his sound post. I become one with the sound as we whirl around the dance floor in a frenzy of pleasure, pulses rippling through me as we fade to grey. I come to my senses in a pile of cold, sweat-drenched sheets, shuddering in the receding wake of the most powerful orgasm I've had since... No, stop. That's far too long ago. I try to roll over. No, too soon. According to the alarm radio, it's 6:45. Not fair. I reach for the light switch and glare bleary-eyed at the violin case on the hotel room desk. Why does it seem to look smug? Bastard, I mutter as I try to sit up. I feel obscurely guilty. It was just an erotic dream. I don't cheat on my husband. At least I don't think I do. Do imaginary violins count? To my sleep-clouded eyes, Lecter's case seems slightly flaccid, slowly pulsing. Or maybe it's just the arteries in the back of my eyeballs. I take a long shower, mainly because I crave the sensation of washing ghostly, adulterous fingertips off my skin. I have to lean against the wall. My knees are so weak. It was positively tectonic. I close my eyes under the warm rain and wish Bob was here to hold me in the afterglow. I dress in my second best work suit, the houndstooth check Jaeger one. It's a bit frumpy, if I'm perfectly honest with myself. Maybe too frumpy. But even though my work wardrobe needs an overhaul in light of my new job, I am damned if I'm going to get into a sartorial arms race with Mary. Before she became a fang, she was merely pretty. Now she could take up modelling if it wasn't for the slight bursting into flames when exposed to bright lights problem. I go with the lowest heels and the least office makeup I can get away with. I've got a lot of walking to do today. I don't bother with the vile hotel breakfast. Instead, I collect Lecter and I'm out the door by 8:30, straight into the comfortingly anonymous rush hour crowd and on my way to the first appointment of the day. Nobody sane drives in London. I take the bus. By the time I get to my destination, I've lost most of my early mover time, but I've had a chance to come fully awake, meditate for a few minutes, and go over my agenda 3 or 4 times in search of holes. I can't spot any. I fend off flashbacks as I walk back along a stretch of pavement that rings under my heels with echoes of the other day's walk to the scaffold experience. I'm reasonably centred again, back in my professional sweet spot. And more importantly, I know what to expect today. So I'm feeling reasonably confident when I march up to the front desk of Belgravia Police Station and say, "Dominique O'Brien to see Chief Inspector Sullivan. I have an appointment." For a moment, I'm afraid the desk sergeant is going to succumb to my middle-aged invisibility field. But then his roving eyeballs land on my warrant card and his pupils dilate slightly as it snags the surface of his mind.
Yes, ma'am.
He doesn't exactly snap to attention. His attitude is more like one of suppressed annoyance at having his routine interrupted by the urgent need to perform hand-holding duties for a senior officer who ought to know better. But, suddenly, he's all over the switchboard.
DCI Sullivan, please. A Dr. O'Brien is waiting for you.
Where?
I'll send her over right away, ma'am.
He looks back at me.
She's in the custody suite, ma'am. The special one. Is that where you're expecting to find her?
I nod. Which way is it? He grabs a constable who is hurrying past.
Julie, would you be a dear and show the superintendent here to the special custody suite? DCI Sullivan is waiting on her.
Julie, suffering the be a dear in professional silence, leads me through the badger set that is the backside of the police station. Scuffed white paint, flickering overhead tubes, and a pervasive smell of stale coffee. And then down a concrete stairwell to a heavy steel door overlooked by half a dozen cameras in armoured enclosures.
This is the old custody suite, ma'am. The main one's on the other side of the building. We were using this to store the riot kit until they repurposed it for the differently empowered 3 months ago. Have they filled you in on that? The special handling requirements.
I'm here to see Jo Sullivan about it, I reassure her. She'll fill me in.
Great. May I go? I was on my way to a briefing when... Go on. Pause. And thanks. I call after her, rapidly receding back. Then I turn to the heavy steel door, the like of which one normally only finds in bank vaults and other places that store stuff that really shouldn't be allowed to escape. There is a very prosaic white plastic doorbell stapled inexpertly to the wall next to it. I push the button. A minute later, there is a squeal of inadequately lubricated gears as the door slides open a crack. Dominique, good to see you again. I cross the threshold and shake hands with Joe. The threshold is about 10 centimeters thick and cross-hatched with yellow stripes and warning stickers showing the grisly things that will happen to you if you happen to be standing in the doorway when the power door closes. So, this is the superhero lockup. Yeah, one of them. Joe takes a step backwards and gestures me in. As I follow her, the huge vault-type door winds shut behind me. It closes a lot more smoothly than it opens. There's a thunk of steel bolts sliding home. Then I notice the background hum of the air conditioners. The interview suites are over there. That corridor leads to 3 cells, that one leads to facilities, staff restrooms, custody officer's room, and a ready room. They're only Cat B secure. We can't store uber-villains here, but it's the best we can do this close to the centre of town. At least until the Crossrail TBMs come available to dig the deep London lockup they've been talking about. How about a coffee while we discuss your request? Uh-oh. A coffee would be great, thanks. I see. And she leads me to the ready room. It does not escape my attention that the entire underground custody suite seems to be embedded in reinforced concrete and has its own air supply. What is this? A former nuclear bunker? Yes, that's exactly what it used to be. She switches on the battered kettle. Most of the central London police stations built before 1970 have them. Anyone trying to use them for shelter probably didn't stand a prayer. But they'd still be structurally sound after the rubble stopped bouncing, unlike most of the other buildings, and we'd have needed somewhere for the surviving officers to use as a station. The cells were to be used as dormitories and arms lockers. Why? Wouldn't you have needed them as, well, cells? Jo shakes her head. Not after a nuclear war, Mo. Think martial law and firing squads. She grabs 2 chipped mugs from the cupboard and sloshes coffee and milk into them. Be glad it never happened. I fear that we might yet end up going that way if we can't get a handle on Case Nightmare Green. I take my mug and sit down. Has he coughed yet? She's a stand-and-pace type. Alas, yes. Unfortunately, our little canary has gone Section 2 on us. He's absolutely upney. Footnote. The next stop out from barking on the district line, as in barking mad. Halfway to Dagenham, in fact. We're keeping him here because he's not deemed a hazard to himself. But so far, he's confessed to assassinating Margaret Thatcher. But Maggie died of natural causes. Yes, exactly. He's also confessed a conspiracy to rob the Bank of England, which is flat-out impossible because he was in custody right here at the time he says he did it. He's delusional about other subjects as well. The duty psychiatrist spent some time assessing him yesterday and thinks he's unfit to stand trial. He's raving about conspiracies and mad scientists trying to take over the world and radio receivers in his head. We did some background legwork and found he was diagnosed paranoid schizophrenic 4 years ago. Looks like he'd been off his meds for some time and was already going downhill fast. He was sectioned twice in the past 9 months, when he came down with an acute attack of superpoweritis. Oh dear. I take a mouthful of coffee. It is, if anything, even worse than the hotel buffet brew. When my eyes uncross, I take another gulp. The last thing I need is a caffeine headache. Well, since I've come this far, I suppose I ought to interview him anyway. You'll be lucky to get anything out of him. Listen,
I've talked to more than my fair share of paranoid schizophrenics over the years, and you get a handle on them after a while. Most of them are lovely people. They just can't stop hearing things. And they get mood swings and medication side effects and obsessive-compulsive tics. Spratt's different. His powers mean he expresses his delusions, sometimes violently, on whoever's around him. And something about him doesn't feel right. If I was a shrink, I'd say he's under the influence of something else. But the duty doc took bloods and he's clean. So what you're seeing is you don't expect me to get anything out of him. Yes. Also, about that. You know we're going to have to do the rules of evidence tap dance and haul the duty solicitor in if Laughing Boy so much as looks like he wants representation. Oh, hell. I take another mouthful. Well, my cover can't get any more blown than it is already. And I'm not held to the same rules of evidence as... Yes, you are. Joe's expression is fierce. As long as you're in this, Nick, you're on my turf. And we play by the rules here. No spookhead games permitted. Jack's going down one way or the other. Maybe he'll pull a long stretch in prison, but more likely, he's due to check in for the Broadmoor Rescue. Where he ends up is for the judge and the psychiatrist to figure out. And if your people really want to take him off my hands, that's another option. But as long as he's in my custody, I am not going to permit you to waltz in and jeopardize his conviction. I raise my hands. I surrender. By messing up his inter... Okay. Sorry, Mo. Didn't mean to blow up at you. I've been butting heads with too damn many cowboys and would-be vigilantes recently. Not to mention the tabloid Angham and Flog'em Brigade and a steady stream of superhero-obsessed liquid bullshit raining down from the top of the pyramid. The Home Office are screaming, and whenever they get a bee in their bonnet, we all get stung sooner or later. She begins to calm down and sips on her coffee, then pulls a face. This is disgusting. Really? I'd never have guessed. I push my mug away. I just want to run some names past him. What names? Something I found in a box of cereal. Sorry, Joe, I won't know for sure unless he bites. And, national security? Suppose I say I want to rule him out of the Thatcher assassination inquiry that doesn't officially exist? She shakes her head. That's just peachy. Look, I'm pretty sure you won't get anything out of him, but if you insist, I'll set you up. Interview room 2, 10 minutes time. Okay? I nod. Okay. She disappears, and I finish my vile coffee. The third mouthful stuns my taste buds enough to let the rest slip down without too much pain. I hope this isn't going to turn out to be a wild goose chase. 20 minutes later, a placid-looking custody sergeant fetches me from the break room, where I have forced down a second mug of the stuff festering in the bottom of the filter machine jug, and escorts me to interview room 2.
The chief's already in there with your customer, ma'am. He's a little excitable, so we don't want to leave him alone.
Excitable?
Positively bouncing off the walls and ceiling.
The interview rooms in the superhero lockup are as non-standard as the Police and Criminal Evidence Act 1984 permits. For one thing, there are 2 doors, one opening onto the cell block, the other into the office area. For another thing, the room is split in 2 by a giant sheet of extremely thick, toughened glass. Someone has etched a gigantic containment ward into the glass and grounded the hell out of it just in case. Finally, there's a CCTV camera pointed at the wall. It's all admissible evidence, and if a villain with hitherto unplumbed occult superpowers does something terminally stupid, it might save the lives of the next interview team. On our side of the glass wall, we've got chairs and a desk that supports a DVD recording machine, a box of discs, and sealable envelopes to stash the confessions in. On his side of the wall, Stripjack Spratt
has got 5 thoroughly padded surfaces. Walls, ceiling, floor, even the door is padded. And I'm pretty sure if they had transparent padding for bulletproof glass, they'd have added it to the window. There are wards stenciled on the padding and on every available non-transparent surface. Someone is really worried about stray thaum currents in there. And then, there's Strip Jack Sprat himself.
Have a seat.
Joe winces in time to a meaty thud.
I wish he'd stop doing that.
Strip Jack Sprat is totally naked. It's impossible to ignore. The thud was the noise he made plastering himself across the glass wall upside down. He's right in front of us with one foot in contact with the ceiling and his arms spread wide across the glass in best Spider-Man tradition, which means his pasty-skinned gut bucket and equally pallid wedding tackle are approximately at eye level. He's about 50. BMI just on the high side of clinically obese, totally bald and hairless, and he has eyes like red-rimmed piss holes in the snow. Also, he's gurning like a mad clown. When Sergeant Jackson said he was bouncing off the walls and ceiling, I didn't realise he was speaking literally.
Brian's very literal, says Josephine. Hey, there he goes again.
Sprat, who has been mouthing at us like a catfish, arches his back in an implausible belly-wobbling backflip, then careens across the room and bounces off the rear wall, tumbles to the floor, then falls upwards until his back is plastered to the ceiling. He screams, proving that the glass isn't impervious to sound. It's not a scream of pain, more like a warbling war cry or glossolalia.
Better start recording, I say. This looks messy. If you insist.
Joe pushes a button on the recording decks panel.
Interview requested by Dr. Dominique O'Brien, Security Service, with Chief Inspector Sullivan present, 0946.
She reels off the date and other mandatory notices, then raises her voice to read Sprat his rights under questioning. Sprat ignores her throughout.
All right, Dr. O'Brien, he's all yours. Where to begin?
Good morning, Jack, I try. He ignores me, other than to cease his gurgling scream and fall silent. Jack, I want to ask you some questions. He ignores me. Lying on the ceiling, perfectly recumbent, he looks ready to compete at ignoring intelligence officers for Britain in the Olympics. Jack, you're not helping yourself. Joe spares me a sidelong pitying look. Sprat continues to practice ignoring intelligence officers. I sigh.
Okay, he won't listen to me. How about...
I pick up my violin case and plant it on the table. No response. I unlatch the case, open the lid, and remove the bow. Then, I pick up Lecter. Sullivan grabs my left arm.
Doctor, I hope you're not planning to...
No, I'm not. I'd just like to play him a straight melody with no extras. See if it gets his attention. Look at the shielding around him. He's safe from anything I can do short of taking a sledgehammer to the window. Is that permissible? She gives me a hard look.
Music only.
If I had a practice violin, I'd use it instead of this one, I assure her. This one's valuable. May I? Sprat closes his eyes. After a few seconds, he begins to snore. We'll see about that, someone thinks. I'm not sure whether it's Lecter or me. I push my chair back, stand up, and begin to play the same improvisation on Bela Lugosi's Dead that I took him down with the other day, minus the eerie harmonics from the Hilbert Space pickups. He takes it for about 3 seconds. Then he stops ignoring me. The violent flailing is boring. The bouncing off the walls, floor, ceiling and window like a self-propelled middle-aged sex doll is mildly disturbing. But then, He thumps into the glass face first, less than a meter away from me. So hard that his nose begins to bleed. A snarl of existential hatred plastered across his face.
Motherfucker! He screams. Bitch, fuck, cunt, pissflap, 666, eat my shit!
Oh goody, we have contact. Even if it's bringing out his Tourette's. I raise the bow. Would you like me to play something else? I ask. Joe, I notice, is leaning back very slightly, face set in a deadpan mask of concentration.
No!
He snaps petulantly.
Kill it! Kill it! Kill it with fire!
Kill what? I ask.
It!
He points at me. After a moment, I realise he's trying to indicate the violin. Why should I?
He wants it, he does. The king in yellow, the professor in emerald, the gambling doctor. He put the computer in my brain that says to do what he wants, and he wants it, and he'll have it, and dance to the ditty that destroys the world. The queen in red and the king in yellow. Aya! Aya! Hurts! It hurts!
He clutches his head.
Worst headache ever!
Well, fuck. I put my violin down and make eye contact with Jo, then give a tiny shake of the head. She nods. Useless. Computers, in brains aside, he's hopelessly contaminated with Lovecraft. One last try. Who is the professor? I ask. Are you talking about Freudstein? Spratt stops ranting and looks at me.
What?
He asks, abruptly lucid.
Headaches.
Are you talking about Professor Freudstein? I ask. An expression of abject terror crosses his face.
Not allowed. Computer says no. Hurts.
What's not allowed?
Not allowed. Pain.
Are you forbidden to talk about Professor Freudstein? I ask, slowly and clearly.
No!
Spratt wails, then abruptly drops to the floor like a puppet whose strings have been cut. There is nothing theatrical or contrived about it. I've seen sacks of potatoes with more muscular control. So, by her reaction, has Jo. She spares me a horrified glance, swears, and is out the door so fast she knocks her chair halfway across the room. I stay just long enough to put Lecter back in his case, and I'm about to hurry after Joe and find out where they keep the emergency resuscitation kit, when I glance back at Spratt. He's lying on his back, with his feet against the glass, legs slightly spread, and one arm twisted behind his back. His left cheek is twitching, the heel of his left foot banging on the floor. But to all appearances, my chief suspect has just suffered a massive stroke. I do not get to leave the police station for some time. I am, as they say, unavoidably detained. Not as unavoidably as the late Mr. Spratt, who is pronounced dead at the scene by the on-call doctor. But DCI Sullivan isn't going to let me escape until she's taken me aside for a very free and frank exchange of opinions.
Spill it,
she demands, leaning in my face. I was testing a hypothesis. I hunch my shoulders. I feel dreadful, too exposed, in need of some safe space to retreat into while I get my head centred again. Did I kill Spratt? No, of course not. But I ask them the fatal question. Did you hear about the Bank of England case? I ask more to distract myself than to inform Joe.
The what?
The penny drops instantly. Okay, so they're locking the lid down tight on it. That makes this easier. Listen, Jack may not have been as out of it as your shrink thought. While he was busy doing his thing with the mayor, somebody did something really bad that you haven't been told about and don't want to stick your nose in. Shit. That's not just a major crime. That's the kind that... Yes. That.
We share a moment's conspiratorial silence. Think in terms of the Northern Bank robbery and you'll be on the right track. You'll hear about it after they've completed the emergency damage control. Until then, keep your trap shut.
Jesus wept.
She's gone all clipped and stiff upper lip on me. Utterly aghast.
Good.
She's got the message. Let me give you a brief rundown. The Northern Bank robbery of 2004 was the biggest bank robbery in Northern Irish history. Hell, it was one of the biggest bank robberies anywhere ever. The robbers, using an MO that is eerily familiar to anyone who had dealings with the happy fun guys from the Provisional IRA back in the bad old days, took two bank managers' families hostage to guarantee their cooperation, then hit the bank's cash centre. They were spectacularly successful and got away with a truckload of banknotes. In fact, they were too successful. Northern Bank is an issuing bank, one of the four banks licensed by the Bank of England to print Northern Irish currency. Northern Ireland isn't very large. The robbers stole nearly a tenth of all the banknotes that institution had in circulation. In fact, they stole so much that the bank issued a total currency recall, printed new currency, and hastily took the old ones out of circulation, thereby turning the entire truckload of stolen lucre into high-quality toilet paper. Because it's just a little bit difficult to launder 10% of an entire currency in a couple of months. The, naughty person left a calling card, I tell her. It was signed, Professor Freudstein.
Jesus.
She takes a deep breath.
You think our man was an accomplice or a diversion?
Did he or did he not babble about that name? And about the bank? And kinda sorta confess to being involved in a real crime you didn't know about at the time? Jo looks as if she's sucking on a lemon.
I don't know what to think. But he's dead.
Stroked out when you asked that question, didn't he? I nod jerkily, trying to hold myself together. It was a stroke for sure.
And a massive one.
By the time the duty medic got to him, it was all over bar the autopsy.
Any idea what could have done that?
Jo looks at me sharply. I could speculate about Kay syndrome and untrained superpowers overclocking the firmware until they get holes nibbled all through their grey matter and blow a gasket in the circle of Willis. But I'm not sure she's cleared for it. And anyway, I might be wrong. I confine myself to a pained expression and a shake of the head.
Didn't like him,
but he deserved better.
Don't we all?
She punches me lightly on my left arm.
You have no idea of the shit pile of paperwork that's about to descend on my head, Mo. You have no idea. People are not supposed to die in custody cells anymore. Not unless it's a shitty medical emergency and the duty medic fucks up. And the duty medic wasn't present. Incoming IPCC investigation at 6 o'clock high. I'll be lucky not to get suspended over this, you know.
I swallow. Due in front of the Home Secretary's desk on Monday at 9 o'clock sharp. If I'm not dog food by 10:30, if it's remotely possible to do so, I'll put in a word. Jo doesn't look relieved. She's not naive enough to think that a good word will save an honest cop from being hung out to dry for Madam Executioner's public relations convenience. The Home Sec clearly has her sights set on number 10, and she's a member of the hardline wing of a party who eat their week with gusto because it makes the survivor stronger.
Just promise me that you'll nail the bastard. Or call me so I can nail him. Whoever this Freudstein guy is.
You know I will, I assure her. After which, the rest of the week drains away downhill like floodwater. I steel myself and head across to the new annex to report developments in person to the incorrigible committee. Then, before I head back to the TPCU office, I sneak around to Emma's office and politely request a list of all her other nominations for my team, just in case.
I am wound up like an over-tightened spring, but Bob, the object of my angst, is apparently busy disarming traps in Angleton's office and has his phone set to do not disturb. I can't bring myself to check his own office, so I chicken out and text him a carefully worded query as to Spooky's state of health. Back in the TPCU, everything is running swimmingly. Martin from facilities is hammering and power-screwing furniture together like a one-man IKEA assault team. Sarah is swearing over a glass-fronted equipment cabinet full of flickering LEDs and patch cables. Sam and Nick, the analysts, are installed in an office with two desks, hammering away at tasks assigned to them by Mary, insert token shudder here, who is tucked away in the office adjacent to mine, working on the corner, well, 50% share, of the roadmap that I handed her yesterday evening. So I retreat into my office and work until it's time for the all hands, which goes something like this. "Hello, everybody," I begin. We don't have a boardroom yet. Martin is still bolting chairs together, so we're all standing in the lobby area behind the glass wall. It's all a little stiff, but at least it's an incentive to keep this short. I'm going to keep this as short as possible. On Monday, today being Friday, at 9 o'clock in the morning, I have to be ready to walk into the Home Secretary's office and deliver a presentation articulating our goals, our strategic plan for achieving those goals, the enabling regulations or primary legislation we need in order to reach those goals in a lawful manner, our required budget, our roadmap for implementation, metrics for assessing our performance on an ongoing basis, and the moon on a stick. I see eyes going wide. Also, some silently mouthed rude words, which I pretend to ignore. Let me emphasise that I do not intend to run this organisation in continuous crunch mode. Crunch mode is bad for morale, worse for productivity, and does terrible things to the shelf life of the milk in the break room fridge. I don't like being on the receiving end of it, and neither do you. But, we got set up too late to fit this all in during our regular 9 till 5 core hours, and there's no way to pull in any more bodies and get them bedded down in time to help. Our next intake isn't due to turn up until Monday afternoon, and our job is to ensure that we're still in business when it's time to receive them. So, I'm hoping everybody is able to stay late tonight and to be in and working tomorrow and Sunday as well. I pause. Keep track of your hours, and once we're fully staffed and stable, I'll sign you all off for time and a half in lieu to make up for it. I pause again. Does anyone have a real problem with that? Hospital appointments, elderly parents or infants, or some other immovable obstacle? Nick's hand rises hesitantly. I don't wait for him to speak. Don't want to risk embarrassing him in front of everybody else. Email me or see me in my office. If I can help out, if it's something I can help out with, I'll move heaven and earth to do so. If not, you're off the hook. We'll figure something out. I have a bottle of water. I take a swig. Now, as to the strategy and the plan. Our job is to get out in front of the superhero/supervillain/superpower problem. I don't believe in one-size-fits-all solutions, so we're going to go wide, not deep. One task will be analysis and forward intelligence. Nick and Sam both perk up at that. A second task will be police and home office liaison and support. It's no good for us to know all about the problem if we don't tell anybody. And approaching it from the opposite direction, if we can get the Home Office on board, they can be a huge force multiplier for us. The third task is public relations. We need to generate a message about how the government wants the newly superpowered to behave, and we need to get it out through all available media. Our fourth and final task, really a subsidiary of the third, is to go after the high-end threats ourselves. And that means we need a framework for managing superpowers directly. That creates a stir. Good. Let them think about it for a while. Mary smirks knowingly and taps the toe of one glossy black pump as if she's impatient to give the game away. I make eye contact briefly, and the smirk vanishes. She nods, imperceptibly. You're a deputy director, bloody act like it. That's all for now, I add. I sent out new task assignments 5 minutes ago. They should be in your inboxes by the time you get back to your desks. Finish up what you're working on today, and let me know what your obstacles are. My door's open. And that, I realise with a start, is everything I needed to say. Because there's nothing left but a dismal weekend of 16-hour workdays in the office, followed by a visit to the lion's den on Monday. And then, if we're really lucky, we will get the green light of approval for my master plan. It's a crazy scheme, but it just might work.